Here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today's date is the 9th of April, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Your mind is your primary weapon. I'll get back to our study on guerrilla warfare. Have quite a few border news items. I haven't ran this one to the ground, but I heard that there was a horse trailer with a bunch of illegal aliens in the back of it in California, and the horse trailer overturned. Now, I don't know the injuries or what that part is, but I guess that happened just this weekend. A lot of talk down here in Arizona of about the border, the National Guard, illegal aliens, the law. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today to the Liberty Tree Radio, and thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. As always, we send this out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. Bob Miner's telephone number, if you'd like to call and leave a short message of encouragement, 701-251-2365, 701-251-2365. Message will come on if you'd like to speak to him or purchase phone cards, and then it'll ask you to punch in the first three digits of the last name, and that's spelled M-I-N-E-R, so it would be 646, and you'll have about 7 to 10 seconds to leave a message. If you'd like to send a letter to Bob directly, it's first for the top line is SCCC, so that'd be Sierra Charlie Charlie Charlie, 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. SCCC 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. Also, the street address for the property there where Bob used to be. It's the Miner family, M-I-N-E-R, 7607 95th Street Southeast, Forbes, North Dakota, 58439, 7607 95th Street Southeast, Forbes, North Dakota, 58439. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horse's mouth, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which are though they are so great and are driven by fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue amongst our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beasts, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessings and cursings. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. Who is a wise man and endureth with knowledge amongst you? Let him show out of good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. But if ye have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensational, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace to them that make peace. James 3. Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. A long time, long way to go and a short time to get there. A couple of border issues I'd like to cover. For the long-time listeners of Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon, we've covered this before. This one's from InsideCrime.com, 29 March 2018. Two former police officers in Mexico's most dangerous state for journalists have been convicted of murdering a newspaper owner, a rare sentence in a country where impunity reigns in nearly all cases of violence against journalists. Two former police officers for the municipality of Medellin de Bravo in Mexico's southeastern state of Veracruz have been sentenced to 25 years in prison for the January 2015 murder of newspaper owner Moises Sanchez, according to a recent press release from the Veracruz Attorney General's office. The ex-officers, identified as Luigi Heriberto N. and Jose Francisco N., were found guilty of intentional homicide and breach of legal duty. In addition to being sentenced to 25 years in prison, the former cops were ordered to pay damages of 332,000 pesos. Sanchez, who had received threats for his reporting on government corruption and violence as the owner of local newspaper La Union, was taken from his home in early January 2015 and found decapitated and dismembered later that month. This next item is from the cbp.gov/newsroom, dated 29 March 2018. Yuma Border Patrol agents arrest convicted rapist. Yuma Station Border Patrol agents arrested a previously deported Mexican national with multiple felony convictions late Tuesday. At approximately 9:30 p.m., agents arrested Jose Araujo Dominguez, a 50-year-old Mexican national, after he illegally entered the United States west of Yuma near the Morales Dam and Levee Road. During processing, agents discovered that Araujo Dominguez had multiple felony convictions out of Hood River, Oregon, to include first-degree rape, first-degree burglary. Additional record checks revealed convictions for vehicle theft and criminal trespass. Araujo Dominguez was last deported from El Paso, Texas, 9 days ago. He admitted he was attempting to travel to Colorado to take up residence. Let's see, Araujo Dominguez is being prosecuted for reentry after deportation as an aggravated felon, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Next one is cbp.gov/newsroom. Nogales CBP officer seized methamphetamine. 29 March 2018, U.S. Customs Border Protection officers at Arizona's port of Nogales apprehended a Tucson woman involved in an unsuccessful attempt to smuggle more than 60 pounds of methamphetamine into the United States Wednesday. Officers working at the Mariposa Crossing referred a 23-year-old woman for further inspection of her Nissan hatchback last night. A CBP narcotics detection canine alerted to an odor it was trained to detect, resulting in drugs being identified within the quarter panels and firewall. Nearly 61 pounds of meth were seized, worth more than $182,000. Officers seized drugs in the vehicle or turned subject over to U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement Homeland Security. One more here. Borderlandbeat.com, 30 March 2018, unstoppable violence in Michoacán. They find a van with five bodies. Chiquiltán, Michoacán. the struggles and purges within various cells of organized crime operating in Michoacan continue without reprise, particularly in the municipalities adjacent to Jalisco in areas known as the West and Cienega de Chapala. This Wednesday, in a truck were found the corpses of five men who showed signs of violence. It is presumed that the victims were narcomenudistas of the Jalisco Cartel Nueva Generacion, the CJNG. At about 11:30 a.m., the police in Michoacan were informed the presence of an abandoned car with several bodies inside in it on a street in the Los Remedios community. The uniformed people went to the place on the such-and-such a street adjacent to another place that's hard to pronounce, where they inspected a gray Chevy Suburban truck in apparent state of abandonment and in whose interior the bodies were found, which they turned over to the prosecutor's office. Regional of La Piedad specialized experts carried out the removal of bodies of five men with evident traces of violence who were reportedly shot to death. Some of the victims were half naked and had pieces of rope on their wrists and feet. After the performance of experts, prosecutors turned the order to remove transfer corpse forensic medical services so that the autopsy required by law would be carried out while the van was secured and placed at the disposal of the corresponding authority. Continuing violence. I guess there was some other supposed chemical attack in Syria. And, of course, they're going to blame that on President Assad, which doesn't seem to make sense. If he's winning it and got the popular support, why would supposedly he gas his own people? Let's see what else. There was a car accident, a vehicle accident up in, I think it was Ontario, Canada, over the weekend, where a truck ran into a bus. The bus was carrying some junior hockey team. Initially, they said that there were 14 people that were killed, and then an hour later, they said that it went up to 15. I guess they evacuated one of them and they died at the hospital or however those are. Now, I noticed that when there's a shooting incident in a school in Florida, then all of a sudden it's a cry to ban guns because guns are bad and cause mass violence. But I don't know, are we hearing anything about a move to ban trucks and buses? Well, you know, these are automatic weapons, so I wonder if the truck or the bus had the automatic transmission. You know, there's also, it's this blame game, too, kind of meditating, contemplating this whole events that had happened. You know, first we blame this, then we blame the sheriff, then we blame the deputy, and we blame the gun that for this school shooting in Florida. And sometimes the finger-pointing and the accusation might sound on the surface, well, why did this deputy not go in here? But what happens is when then we get further and further from the truth, because it wasn't the sheriff's fault, it wasn't the deputy's fault, it wasn't the gun's fault, it was the shooter's fault. When we get into the point of looking at video of the deputy that drives up, that's the school resource officer, and doesn't go in, then it's easy to fall into the same category of the school students trying to blame the gun for the actions of the shooter. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the NRA or the sheriff or the deputy or anything, but sometimes, and it's kind of ties right in with our reading of James 3 this morning as to where it's about the tongue and sometimes of how we say things. There's a line in the opening song that we play here, "On Your Mind Is Your Primary Weapon." We can say some things and hurt people without not even knowing it, and that kind of ties right in. Kind of interesting, too, in James 1, James 2, it addresses some of these issues that, you know, when we get up in the morning and we look in the mirror and something's out of place, whether we have piece of food stuck between our teeth or our hairs out of, we usually do something about it. We don't look in the mirror and then just turn around and go about our day. And, well, because, say for instance, you have a vehicle, and hopefully you have spare oil in the engine. But let's just say, for instance, you don't have a spare can of oil, so why would you go check the dipstick if you didn't have any oil to replace it with? It kind of sounds like a wasted step. You can't do anything about it. And again, then why would we look at our reflection in the mirror and not do anything about it? James is one of the shorter books of the Bible, but it has a lot of power. And it has to do with deeds and not words. We can say we're going to do something, and that's like looking in the mirror without doing something about it. And that's kind of the part that your mind is your primary weapon, and the rest of the people in the Patriot community, when they get on the air and they talk about actions, and hopefully this will spark people's reaction to translate words into deeds. And we all do our part, and that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. I don't necessarily talk about what I do, because it kind of reminds me of the part also in the Bible that about the publicans that get up in front and make these grandioso speeches, and they like to be invited so they can sit at the head of the banquet table, and then they'll talk about what they contributed, and the widow's mite of it's pointed out that she only came in and basically put 2 pennies in the collection basket, but she gave more than the publicans did, even though monetarily they contributed more, but they only gave a small percentage of their money, but she gave everything she had. So, as Mark Kornke often says, many hands make for light work. So it really doesn't matter if you have 2 cents or $2,000. It's translating that from words into deeds. And before I let my tongue blaspheme, I should just move on with, but you know where we're going. We're talking about the political and the military objectives. And the enemy advances, we retreat. The enemy camps, we harass. The enemy tires, we attack. The enemy retreats, we pursue. Selected military writings of Mao Zedong. Because what Mao's talking of guerrilla tactics, and that's the key to the communist thinking, and it can be discerned in diplomacy as well as in war. The Soviet policymakers have mastered the Chinese lesson very well and apply it to a wide variety of problems having nothing to do with guerrilla fighting. Berlin, since World War II, has been a prime example, and the establishment of Soviet missile bases in Cuba. But then, why not? The policy of hitting the enemy when he is weak, evading him when he is strong, taking the offensive when he falls back, circling around when he advances. All of this is only common sense, and there's no greater novelty in it, nor can the Marxist-Leninist camp claim any special credit for it. But what is new, and now is the apostle, and the long Chinese Revolution, the first proving ground, in the application of guerrilla activity in a conscious and a deliberate way, and to specific political objectives without immediate reference to the outcome of battles. Provide only that the revolutionaries survive. See, we're down at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about that it's the non-communist Cubans rather than the Chinese who have provided the most clear-cut example of the military activity producing political effects in a war in which few of the battles would be described by military men as more than skirmishes, yet one in which the government came crashing down as surely as if the army had been destroyed on the battlefield. We'll be right back. And that's the point. We have to join together with the band, and we need to bridle our tongues. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today's date is the 9th of April, 2018. It's Monday. Your mind is your primary weapon. Covered a lot of things in the first 30-minute block of today's broadcast. Talked about some administrative stuff, Bob Miner's contact information, read out of James 3, the border news, couple three items there of what's going on, and discussing a little bit of about the political and the military objectives in insurgency. Now, when we left off, it's talking about how is, as the example about the Cubans, that they've provided some pretty clear-cut examples of military activity, because with most of their quote-unquote battles, they'd be described by the military men as more than just skirmishes, but the government came crashing down as if its army had been destroyed on the battlefield. Now, sometimes that explanation seems to baffle the military men, but yet it's simple enough, because guerrillas who know their trade and have popular support cannot be eliminated by the means available to most governments. And on the other hand, few governments can stand the political, psychological, and economic stress of guerrilla war, no matter how strong they may be militarily. Now, in general, all warfare involves the same basic problem: how to use one's strength to exploit the enemy's weakness and so to overcome him. Now, in an internal war, the government's strength is its powerful army, its arsenal, and its wealth of material means. Its weaknesses are social, political, and economic, in the sense that the economy, while an asset, is vulnerable from several points of view, and it provides both military and psychological targets. Constitutional democracies are particularly exposed to the subversion that's the basic weapon of revolutionary war, and the stratified class structure and the multi-party political system of most countries are sources of political and social dissension that can be exploited. And constitutional law is a further embarrassment and sometimes may be a fatal impediment. Batista fell in Cuba, not because he was a dictator, but because his situation in a country with a democratic institutions, a country almost entirely dependent on the favor of the United States, with its similar institutions and traditions, did not permit him to be a dictator enough to resolve the contradictions that confronted him. His hands were tied by conventions he could not break without losing his foreign support. His use of counterterrorism, the so-called illegal use of force, only increased his domestic opposition, but without it, he had no effective means to combat the disorder and the subversion that threatened his regime. Similarly, the French in Indochina were destroyed in the final analysis by the very ideas and institutions that they themselves had introduced. Franco, by way of a contrast, probably stood because he was successfully stifled the very idea of political liberty in Spain while putting enough bread on the table to satisfy the vocal majority. So, this is to speak of legalistic, that is, a social and political difficulties. Now, on a military level, a regular army, under whatever political system, has disadvantages that are owing to its very size and complexity of the organization. And it is a defensive role as the guardian of the national wealth and the whole of the national territory. Now, the guerrilla, for his part, finds his strength in his freedom from territorial commitments, his mobility, and his relationship to a discontented people as the spokesman of their grievances, the armed vanguard, as Che Guevara put it, of militant social protest. His weakness is merely and we'll use the word advisedly, a military weakness. He lacks the aims and usually the manpower to risk a military decision. But in the circumstances, it's obvious what the guerrilla tactics may be. And that needs to be the political. And he may seek to aggravate such social and political dissension as exists and to rise the level of the political consciousness and of revolutionary will amongst the people. It will also be part of his design as well as the natural consequence of his action to bring about an intensification of the political repression that already exists, and that deepens the popular opposition to the regime and hastening the process of its dissolution. Now, militarily, his tactics will be designed to wear down the enemy down by chipping away at the morale of the government troops and by inducing the maximum expenditure of funds, material, and manpower in the effort to suppress him. And at the same time, he'll going to endeavor to build his own forces through the capture of government arms and by recruitment from an increasingly alienated populace, avoiding a military confrontation and until the day, and you're assured that it will come when an equalization of force has been obtained. Now, any army deals from strength, seeking out the enemy's weakness in order to destroy him. The guerrilla is sometimes said to deal from weakness, but that's an absurdity. In fact, he exploits his own kind of strength, which lies in the extreme mobility of lightly armed forces without territory or hardware investments, a bottomless well of manpower from which to recruit, and the fact that time, which is both money and political capital, works in his favor. As an analogy, a guerrilla fights the war of a flea, and his military enemy suffers the dog's disadvantage. Too much to defend, too small, ubiquitous, and agile an enemy to come to grips with. If the war continues long enough, this is the theory, the dog succumbs to exhaustion and anemia without ever having found anything on which to close its jaws or to rake with its claws. But this may be an oversimplification for the sake of the analogy, because in practice the dog does not die of anemia. He merely becomes too weakened, and in military terms, overextended, and in political terms, too unpopular, in economic terms, too expensive to defend himself. Now, at this point, the flea, having multiplied to the vertebral plague of fleas through long series of small victories, each drawing its drop of blood, each claiming the reward of a few more captured weapons to arm yet a few more partisans, concentrates his force for a decisive series of powerful blows. Time works for the guerrilla both in the field, where it costs the enemy a daily fortune to pursue him, and in the political economic arena. Because most all modern governments are highly conscious of what journalism calls world opinion. For sound reasons, mostly of an economic nature, they cannot afford to be condemned in the United Nations. They do not like to be visited by human rights commissions or freedom of the press committees. Their need for foreign investment, foreign loans, foreign markets, satisfactory trade relations, and so on, requires that they be members in more or less good standing of a larger community of interest. Often, too, they are members of military alliances. Consequently, they must maintain some appearance of stability in order to assure the other members of the community or of the alliance that contracts with continue to be honored, and that treaties will be upheld, that loans will be repaid with interest, that investments will continue to produce profits and be safe. And protracted internal war threatens all of that. Therefore, no investor is going to wish to put his money where it's not safe and certain a product of profit, and no bank lends without guarantees. No ally wishes to treat with a government that is on the point of eviction. So it follows that it must be the business of the guerrilla and of his clandestine political organization in the cities to destroy the stable image of a government and so to deny its credits, to dry up its sources of revenue, and to create dissension within the frightened owning classes within the government bureaucracies whose payrolls will be pinched and within the military itself. Now, the outbreak of an insurgency is the first step. It is a body blow that in itself inflicts severe damage on the prestige of the regime, and the survival of the guerrilla force over a period of time, demonstrating the impotence of the army, continues the process. And then as the guerrilla support widens, and this will come automatically as the weakness of the government is revealed, the political trouble is sure to follow in the forms of petitions, demonstrations, and strikes. And these, in turn, are going to be followed by more serious developments, sabotage, terror, spreading insurrection. Now, in those circumstances, it'll be a remarkable government that will not be driven to stem repressive measures. And the curfews, the suspension of civil liberties, a ban on popular assembly, illegal acts that can only deepen the popular opposition, creating a vicious cycle of rebellion and repression until the economy is undermined, the social fabric torn beyond redemption, and the regime tottering on the verge of collapse. And in the end, it'll be a question whether government falls before the military is destroyed in the field, or whether the destruction of the military brings about the final disposition of the political regime. And the two processes are complementary. Social and political disillusion bleeds the military, and the protracted and futile campaign in the field contributes to the process of social and political disillusion, creating that what's been called a climate of collapse. And that's the grand strategic objective of the guerrilla, to create the climate of collapse, and it may be taken as the key to everything he does. Now, we want to also note that do not by any means to suggest that the train of events that we've described can be put in motion anywhere, at any time, by any agency, irrespective of objective and subjective conditions. Insurrections may be provoked or incited or may occur spontaneously as the expression of grievances or the frustrated aspirations, or because of other factors, religious frenzy, blood feuds, mass hysteria induced by anything from a sporting contest to a rape in Mississippi can lead to bloodshed and temporary anarchy. Guerrilla warfare does not necessarily follow. Insurrection is a phenomenon, a revolutionary process, which cannot begin until the historical stage has been set for it. Because since guerrilla war is, in our definition, a revolutionary process, it can only come out of a revolutionary situation. And so, for that reason, we'll be inclined to agree with Che Guevara when he writes in his book, Guerrilla Warfare, "Naturally, it is not to be thought that all conditions for revolution are going to be created through the impulse given to them by the guerrilla activity. It must also be kept in mind that there is a necessary minimum without which the establishment and consolidation of the first center of rebellion is not practicable. people must see clearly the futility of maintaining a fight for social goals within the framework of civil debate. When the force of oppression come to maintain themselves in power against established law, peace is considered already broken. Because in these conditions, popular discontent manifests itself in more active forms. An attitude of resistance crystallizes in an outbreak of fighting, provoked initially by the conduct of the authorities. When a government has come into power through some form of popular vote, fraudulent or not, and maintains at least an appearance of constitutional legality, the guerrilla outbreak cannot be promoted since the possibilities of peaceful struggle have not yet been exhausted. We've defined guerrilla war as the extension of politics by means of armed conflict. And it follows that the extension cannot logically come until all applicable peaceful solutions, appeals, legislative and judicial actions, and the resources of the ballot box have been proved worthless. Were it otherwise, there would be no hope of enlisting the popular support essential to the revolutionary activity. If the people are to accept the risk and responsibilities of organized violence, they must believe, first, that there is no alternative, second, that the cause is compelling, and third, that they have reasonable expectations of success. Now, the last name is perhaps the most powerful of motives. Where the cause appears just, the situation is intolerable, and oppression past all appeal, the way to action is clear. But even then, however, much groundwork must be done before a guerrilla campaign will become feasible, because the experience in Algeria, of Cuba, and other successful revolutions indicate that in most circumstances, guerrillas require the active support of the political organization outside of their own ranks, but dedicated to their cause, an urban arm of the revolutionary movement that can provide assistance by means both legal and illicit, from placing bombs to defending accused revolutionaries in the court of laws, assuming that those still exist. Isolation, military, and political is the great enemy of the guerrilla movement. And it's the task of the urban organization to prevent the isolation, to provide diversions and provocations when needed, to maintain contact, to keep the world aware of the revolution in progress, even when there is no progress to report. And usually the revolutionary political organization will have two branches, one subterranean and illegal, and the other visible and quasi-legitimate. Now, on the other hand, there's going to be other activists, saboteurs, terrorists, arms runners, fabricators of explosive devices, operators of clandestine presses, distributors of political pamphlets, and couriers to carry messages from one guerrilla sector to the other, using the towns as communication centers. Now, on the other hand, there will be sympathizers and fellow travelers, those not really of the underground, operating for the most part within the law, but sustaining the efforts of the activists and of themselves, accomplishing far more important tasks. And the visible organization will, of course, have invisible links with the revolutionary underground and through it with the guerrillas in the countryside. But the real work will be to serve as respectable facade for the revolution, a civilian front, or as the Cubans called it, resistencia civacia, made up of intellectuals, tradesmen, clerks, students, professionals, and of all, above all, of women capable of promoting funds, circulating petitions, organizing boycotts, raising popular demonstrating, informing friendly journalists, spreading rumors, and in every way conceivable, waging a massive propaganda campaign aimed at two objectives. The first, strengthening and brightening the rebel image, and second, of discrediting the regime. Now, when we come back next week, we want to talk about the inception and the evolution of an insurgency, the transition to civil war, the alternate solutions, and as an example of the Cuban Revolution. Now, sometimes when we do our studies, I'll mention the Cubans or Mao or multitude, the French Indochina or in Algeria, and I have found over the years of when I study these things, even though politics is an integral, the political subversives that have to exist first, last, and always in an insurgency, but when I study the tactics and the techniques and the procedures of the insurgent, I don't get bogged down into their political ideology. I don't condemn Mao because he was a communist. I don't condemn Fidel because he became a communist, or the Soviets, or the Nazis, or the this group, or the that group. Because then sometimes, because we've been propagandized over the years that this is good and this is bad, and then that has a tendency to cloud our view of what we're actually trying to examine, and that's the tactics, the techniques, and the procedures of how an insurgency can be waged. Because let us say that the cause does exist. Remember, the conditions have to be right. An insurgency can't just happen because you want it to, because your peaceful alternatives have been exhausted, and the revolutionary organizations have come into being, perhaps only in a skeletal form, but let's just say sufficient to the immediate need. Now, somewhere in the remotest province, which will be the most revolutionary because of the most neglected and the most favorable to the guerrilla actions, because the most primitive and inaccessible, and the insurrection breaks and spreads. A rebel band springs into existence, composed of armed civilians who call themselves patriots, and whom the government will call bandits, or militia, or communists. And our government arsenal is assaulted, a police post is burned, a radio station is briefly seized, and a proclamation is issued in the name of the revolution. And the hour is at hand. The people are in arms. The tyrant or puppet or foreigner must go. A blow has been struck for national liberation, and the lines of battle are drawn. The aims and the principles of the revolution are specified in appropriate rhetoric with patriotic references and historical footnotes. They are just aims, worthy principles, but who would propose any others? They involve popular grievances, and they strike a popular response. The towns and the countryside are abuzz with rumors. Young men and boys who have longed for the day of decision hasten to consult one another as to the role that each can or should or will play in the conflict to come. Members of the opposition parties who have heretofore confined their transiencies to the lecture platform and the writings of editorials now must take a position. The blow that has been struck is a catalyst deciding new alignments and future attitudes. But who will join the rebels? Who will walk the neutral line or abandon his principle and make a common cause with the oppressor? Since it's not the nature of the government to treat with armed civilians, the insurrection must be put down, order established, and confidence restored. And already there is discreet questions being put by foreign embassies. And although these embassies want reassurances, they are not above consulting with the political opposition, but they may even establish an informal liaison with the rebels, both to gain intelligence and by way of insurance. Business leaders and banks, both foreign and domestic, will be close behind and not always so discreet. And the situation, if allowed to develop, is certain to attract foreign journalists and the rebels, perhaps insignificant in themselves from the government's point of view, will then find the platform from which to amplify their cause and the embarrassment of the regime a thousandfold. Well, we've come up to the end of today's broadcast. I hope I'm planting some seeds to get you thinking about what I'm talking about. I hope that these are broadcasts that are worth your while. And if they are worth your while, I would ask you to please help support Liberty Tree Radio and the Micro Effect, because your mind is your primary weapon. And we need to think about these things. It's one thing to go rallying over here into Armpit, Arizona, and standing around with your camouflage clothes and your guns and saying, we want change, and try to develop the organization after the fact. The organization must exist. The political subversives must exist first, last, and always before anything else has a chance. Thanks for being with us today, and I'll see you back here next Monday on Liberty Tree Radio, but also I'll be on the Micro Effect tomorrow. Well, you guys take care of yourself. Be safe. Your mind is your primary weapon.